Hi folks, welcome to this special edition of Brokenomics, where I will be putting your questions to Dan, because we've had five episodes of it now, and I think Dan's explained it relatively well. It's clear enough for a simpleton like me to understand, but obviously it's a complex subject, and you're explaining from the position of an expert who might not necessarily know exactly what it is that the audience needs to know and the missing pieces in.
Yeah, possible. I skipped a step or two, so
Well, that's the thing. You know, there are always assumptions. And so we thought what we'd do is go through just each episode and ask any questions that were left as comments on each one. So I suppose we'll start with Brokenomics number one, which is your introduction, in which you covered the general scope of this series. And so I suppose we'll start with Ben's question here. Something I've been wondering since you first told me about the petrodollar, if the US have a hold over the market with the petrodollar, how come they're pushing for all this net zero renewable stuff? Surely they'd want everyone to continue with fossil fuels.
Yeah, that is actually a really good question. Mm. And you got to think that there is some sort of misdirection amongst the elites, that the left hand doesn't know what the far left hand is doing.
Yeah.
Because I think the push for solar and renewables, that's coming a lot more from the WEF, which I associate more with the sort of the old banking families of the old vested power interests of Europe. Mm. Whereas the petrodollar, yeah, that's very much focused around the US's interests. Mm. And I think they're sort of pulling at each other. And it's probably because there hasn't been an awful lot of joined up thinking. And actually what they've done more recently with the shutting down of the Russian foreign reserves, that sort of takes away the dollar from being a universal currency that everybody can use. So it's sort of pulling against those two things. Now, I heard rumours that people who are financially literate, when Biden first did that and he first took away those Russian reserves, that people from the Treasury Department and the people from the Fed sort of going around saying to everybody, we weren't consulted. We weren't involved in this discussion at all.
I like the idea that Janet Yellen is financially literate.
More so than the average White House staffer, I think. I think the elite are sort of pulling in different directions. Mm. But yeah, that does start to clash. And actually, if anything, you're starting to see elements within sort of the US financial elite starting to push back against a lot of this stuff.
Well, from my perspective, it just seems to be obvious ideological capture of the elite class of the Americans, Americas, because like one of the problems with the environmental lobby is that it's hard to be able to actually formulate a moral pushback, because we want a clean planet with renewable energy. It's like, well, that's an unvarnished good. Mm. There's no downside to the idea of a clean planet with renewable energy. And so you can't really say, yeah, but petrodollar, because they'll just say, well, no, this is killing the planet. And so you need to be able to push back. And the only way you could really do it is through real politic, by saying, well, look, if we do this, we lose our grasp on the entire world.
Yeah,
and that's a very moral argument.
I think that's very fair. And also, I just don't believe them. I don't think that even they believe it, because why is it that these same people, they go and buy houses, which according to the IPCC, are going to be underwater in 12 years?
Yeah, so they've all got beachfront properties.
Exactly. Yeah. And why are the big banks lending 30 and 40 year mortgages against these properties? Is it because they're prepared to lose money after the first 12 years, or do they not believe it either?
It's because they don't believe Al Gore's predictions, clearly.
Yeah, that is a massive conflict within. If they were joined up thinking, yeah, this clearly doesn't work. So that's a good question.
Yeah, it's definitely ideological intrusion, in my opinion. Jarrett says, what exactly do dollars represent? If I read correctly, there are approximately 21 trillion of the money supply. Does it represent simply goods over which the US has control, or does it represent the goods and services over a time period, which sounds like GDP? The reason for asking is to determine why currencies have varying exchange rates.
So normally what a dollar is based on debt. So it's somebody else's debt. So that figure that he's given there, he's given M3, I would imagine, and that is the sort of total amount of money, just basically money in circulation. But if you were to take the total amount of things that included in sort of near money and other kinds of money as well, it's probably going to be significantly higher than that. I mean, you're talking up into the hundreds. Now, of that, you're probably looking at less than 10 trillion being genuine money, sort of base money that we started with. So if you think back to the story we took us through from the introduction, the money that we started with, which was then based on gold, that's sort of hard real dollars. And then after that time, basically the dollars that were created after that point were sort of loaned into existence.
Can I, it seems to me that a way of phrasing it is promissory, as in this isn't connected to any real world thing, but it's connected to a promise that when it is eventually called upon, as in the debt is to be repaid, then the debt will be repaid, and the whole system seems
and then that money disappears effectively.
Yeah, exactly.
And, so that's why the system has to expand. It has to keep on expanding all the time.
And it seems to rely on just not everyone calling in their debts.
Well, or at least creating new debt at a faster rate than the old stuff is being repaid.
So presumably creating debts to repay the previous debts.
Yes, because I mean that's the weird thing is there isn't enough money to pay off the debt, and there isn't even enough money to pay off the interest on it.
So it's turtles all the way down.
Exactly. Yeah.
Right. That can't last.
And at some point that's going to have to come to an end.
Yeah.
The thing is that it can take a lot longer than you think it's going to take.
Well, I mean, if it's an infinite stack of debt, it just goes down.
At some point, though, you get into the problem of the debt spiral. And the debt spiral is when the rate of debt is growing faster than the rate of
rate of
productivity.
Right.
And when they cross, basically you just end up what you would end up in the end game of a debt spiral is government spending basically all of their revenues on interest payments.
Yeah, because before the money is even created, the value is even created, it's already gone entirely into some previous debt, right?
So think about it like this. So this is the case for the US and the UK. Mm. Our debt is about 100% of GDP.
Right.
So it's like a one-for-one relationship. Now, the coupon on that debt, so the interest rate, is at the moment it's like 4%, 4 to 5%. Mm. So in order to stop the debt growing faster than the economy, you need the economy to grow at greater than 4 or 5%. But here's the problem, we never do.
Right.
So at the moment, we're in this situation where the debt is just going to keep getting bigger as a share of the economy, unless they find some radical way to increase the economic growth, or they push those interest rates back down to zero again.
And so at some point, the debt will effectively just be the entire economy.
Yeah. So, I mean, take the UK, for example. We're spending $120 billion a year at the moment just on the interest payments, which is a big number.
Yeah.
In fact, it's only the only thing bigger than that is the NHS.
I was going to say,
and
the
not
NHS,
much.
Yeah.
The NHS is 144 billion.
Right. Okay.
So you can see that if interest rates go up just a little bit, or the size of the debt goes up just a little bit, interest payments would be the biggest line.
Hmm.
And basically, in this debt spiral scenario, that debt just gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it's like 75% of the revenues, or even more.
Yeah.
And then at that point, it's basically state collapse.
Right. Okay, that's
not good, is it?
No, it's not. You're trying to take it with a bit of levity, but oh my God.
Yes.
Okay. John asks, would Dan address Richard Werner's evidence that banks create money from nothing, not through fractional reserves? He's included a link here, but I haven't seen that.
Well, I mean, that was basically the point I just made.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So it used to be the case that it was a fractional reserve system, and that fraction got reduced. I can't remember the numbers, but something like, I think during Thatcher's time, it was you had to reserve like 15%. So if you paid a pound in, they would have to keep 15p, and then the other 85p they could lend out. And of course, that went to another bank, and then they could lend out 85%, and so on and so on and so on. And where it's got to more recently is that requirement has just gone. So now the way money is created is effectively they create a mortgage, a loan, and then when you start paying it back, that creates the money.
Yeah. So I understand the obvious economic benefits of a fractional reserve system. It allows you to kind of create the fiction that there's more liquid capital available for investment in goods and services. So you can create more real things using this kind of fictional money. But it seems like an obvious grift.
Yes, nobody would have designed this system, but basically they've been digging themselves out of a hole by digging a deeper hole every time.
Yeah.
So the original hole was what happened back in 1971, which was basically the US ran out of money.
Yeah.
They had the Vietnamese war to fight. They had big social programs, and so they needed they basically needed more gold, because on a gold standard they didn't have it.
Is this where they refused the French their gold reserves?
Yeah, so before that time, you could exchange your dollars for gold.
Yeah.
And the French were saying, I don't believe you. So we're gonna have the gold. Thank you very much.
And the US were like, well, yeah, that's a good point. We were lying.
And yeah, exactly. And then Nixon stood up on TV and said, and he made it sound good. It was something like, in order to protect and strengthen America or something, we're going to do this.
Yeah, screw the French.
Yeah, exactly. Well, he screwed everybody.
Yeah, well, yeah.
And at that point on, it was basically a fiat currency. And of course, once politicians realised they had the ability to essentially create money out of thin air, why wouldn't you do that? I mean, your term is going to be, even if you're a really successful politician, your term is going to be like 8 to 10 years.
So when you say backed by nothing, it's got to be backed by something, right?
Well, it's backed by debt.
But even that has to be backed by something. Like, and all I can think of is it's backed by essentially people's faith in the money that already exists in the system and the custom of just using money to pay for those.
Well, it should be backed by the creditworthiness of the borrower.
Right.
So if we're going to lend you money to buy a house, to give you a mortgage, I mean, presumably you're going out there and you're doing something.
Yeah.
So as long as the economy is growing and the population is growing and globalization is occurring, we're bringing more in. As long as everything's growing, you kind of get away with it.
Right.
So you can see why we got away with it for 50 years. And what I was trying to describe in this video is basically that's flipped. Globalization has stopped.
Yeah.
The demographic expansion has stopped. In fact, if anything, it's going to be going backwards because the robots are going to be taking over all our jobs.
Yeah.
And now at that point, it's very difficult to maintain this sort of expansionary effect. And it really started going wrong in 2008.
Right.
And I think it's just getting wronger and wronger as we go on. It's a big blackmail, I know. This series will get a bit more positive, I'm sure, at some point.
Finn asks, I've been told that the petrodollar has reasserted itself in foreign countries under the Biden administration. My understanding is that the value has only increased due to Biden's aggression towards oil drilling in America, and instead of offshoring it to these countries, which would rely on the petrodollar more than before. Surely money printing will still cause the dollar to be devalued, meaning these countries would find it less reliable or valuable and look to alternatives. Would these effects be balanced out, or would one win out, making this reassertion of the petrodollar short-lived?
So I think what he's referring to is the dollar has been reasonably strong lately despite all of this going on. And that's due to a weird effect that everybody has dollar denominated debt. Now what's been happening is as the US has been tightening by raising interest rates, it's caused a shortage of dollars around the world, where people basically need these dollars in order to pay off their debts. So even though it is sort of triggered by a weakness, the end result is that because the dollar is used as an international exchange, the dollar actually goes up.
I'm trying to think of a way that's nice to describe what I'm thinking.
What are you thinking?
It's kind of like the master pulling hard on all of the chains.
Pretty much.
And everyone has to move in that direction, whether they like it or not.
But that does create a problem for the dollar, because the dollar will probably die from its strength rather than its weakness.
Oh, yeah.
Because the dollar is so strong, and it, whenever there's a shortage of it, it causes the dollar to go, as we have seen. I mean, that was a lot of the problem with what was happening with Liz Truss, is that she happened to do what she did at a moment when the dollar was getting really strong, and money was flowing out of other currencies, even sterling, into the dollar. So as the dollar gets stronger, it creates a problem for all of these other countries. So they are going to be looking for an alternative. Now, there used to be a near competitor, which was the euro, but the US over the last year or so has cleverly convinced the Europeans to basically blow themselves up, to deindustrialize themselves, to basically render themselves dependent on US energy. Now, I don't know that was the intention, but that was what happened. So you can view what's been happening over the last year as a very clever play to take out your nearest currency rival, the euro.
That's really interesting, because I can't help but feel this somehow dovetails with the European over-reliance on Russian energy, right?
Yeah. It has achieved multiple results for the US.
Right.
Russia is obviously a geopolitical rival.
Yeah.
So it's weakened them. The euro was a currency rival. It's weakened them. The only problem they've got is the longer term might be even worse for them, because it's created this dollar strength. So now all of these other countries can be thinking, okay, can I find an alternative to the dollar?
But isn't this why Gaddafi ended up getting knocked off?
Yes, but it's harder to knock off China.
Fair.
Yeah.
Fair. There's something about this, though, that makes me think, essentially, this is an incredibly high-stakes game. And it's like asking... Essentially, the US has to be confident in its ability to win wars here, right?
The US definitely does not lack for confidence.
Well, you say that, but look at Afghanistan. Like,
oh yeah, I mean, I'm not saying it always wins. I'm just saying it's always confident.
No. I don't know if they are always that confident, actually. And I suspect that a lot of the fact that the Russia-Ukraine war has been going on for a year now is actually kind of an tacit implication. Actually, maybe the confidence isn't there, and the fact that it's actually quite a narrow band of the world that's actually boycotting Russia. That actually makes me think, is it as strong as they feel it is?
There was a really interesting report that the World Economic Forum put out recently. I did it on the podcast, where I talked about the future that they see, which is a future dependent on commodities, energies and commodities. Mm. And it showed you a sort of chart of where these commodities and energies come from. Now, Russia was all over the energy bit.
Yeah.
So you think, okay, if this is where the global elites feel our future has to be, you want to control Russia. Right. And the second part was the commodities, all the rare earth metals, all the stuff you need to do the energy transition.
Yeah.
China was all over that bit. So if you control those two, that's effectively controlling the future as far as at least the West sees it. Now, I think perhaps what the US was hoping for is to get a Slavic version of Justin Trudeau in Russia.
Well,
and control it that way.
You could compare Zelensky to Trudeau, actually.
Yeah, so if you can get a version of that in Russia and you can control those energy resources, is brilliant. But potentially what they've done is backfired and they've pushed... You've pushed Russia and China together.
Yeah.
Now, if they form a sort of Eurasian bloc and they've got effectively everything they need at that point, because Russia has the energy, China has the capital and the tech and the know-how. The only thing both of those two lack is the sort of the youthful demographic coming up.
As I understood it, that there is a kind of problem with sort of expert skills in China. I think Europe and America are the place where the really high tech stuff is made. Am I correct there?
Yeah, but they can buy it in. So was it RAF RAF pilots?
It was, yeah, for 250k a year going over to China. It's like, right. Yes.
So the RAF kind of say, we're not interested in cis white men anymore.
Yeah.
And they go,
we are
250 grand a year from China then. And expect to see more of that. And in fact, there has been, and you can see this is getting into a trade war, because recently I think Biden did something. I can't remember the details. I didn't know we were going to talk about it, otherwise I would have brought it up. But it's something like China gave people working in certain high-tech fields in China the option of either come home or lose your citizenship or something like that. He really pushed back on bringing the semiconductor industry or high-tech chips or something like that back to the US. And he was really aggressive trying to get these people back. So you can see we're going to get into this sort of bifurcation of the world, effectively, where you've got these two blocks emerging and both sides are going to be sort of playing against each other quite tough.
I'm put in mind of the Chinese spy games that they've been playing in America, stealing technology from American universities and sending them out. This keeps happening. It's not well reported on, though, for some reason. But you'd think numerous Chinese spies stealing American intellectual, not secrets, but
I don't even know how spy-y about it
are. Yeah, I don't know if it's spying, but that's what it feels like.
I went back to my old university campus a little while ago because I was in the area and I thought, oh, I'll just have a look around.
Mm.
And, the buildings are the same as I remember from 20-odd years ago. The thing that struck me is that there were now Chinese people absolutely everywhere.
Yeah.
And apparently this is common. Lots of universities could be, 50% or more Chinese students. And so they don't necessarily even need to spy that hard. They just send loads of people over here, get the skills, and then come back again.
Well, one of the things, they've been just sending a lot of research back to China. It's like, shouldn't the Chinese be paying for this? Sell research to China, but like, that should cost them money. So anyway, let's move on. So Steve asks, would it be possible and or viable to have a dual economy like China? However, Have one system for the people and the other for the government set as a direct exchange, as well as shrink the inflated base, the people's system. Too long, didn't read. Have a salary for the government so they don't spend the taxes on frivolous things.
So, interestingly enough, the European Union put out a paper recently about central bank digital currencies.
Right.
And one of the things that they envisaged using on that was a dual currency system. Right. So effectively, there was a pleb coin and an elite coin. Yeah.
And so, pleb coin. Right. Yeah.
That wasn't their words, but...
Sure, you are, but that's what they're getting at.
I think it was retail CBDC and wholesale CBDC. Mm-hmm. And the pleb coin is used for basically small businesses, people, and interestingly, government. Mm-hmm. And the elite coin is used for banks, financial institutions, big tech, and... bigger organizations like the transnational organizations like the WEF and stuff like that. So, right. So there is a possibility of a sort of dual economy based on that sort of technology if it comes to it. So
that's a bit concerning, though, isn't it?
I mean, everything the WEF are sort of planning is quite concerning. But yeah, there is potential for that.
I mean, what would the exchange rate be between the two? How would it be calculated?
I don't know if you'd necessarily even be able to exchange it. It's just that one would have powers that the other one wouldn't have. So presumably the pleb coin would be monitored at every level, right. Whereas the other one would have complete privacy. So the banks can move money around as they wish. But if you or I buy a bacon sandwich, it gets logged and then that goes against our meat quota for the week.
But I mean, there has to be some sort of method of exchange, or else how does the elite coin ever translate into goods and services produced by pleb coin users?
It might be as simple as when it crosses into their hands,
right?
So if you get given some elite coin, it gets turned into a pleb coin the moment it touches your.
Well, there has to be an exchange rate there, though, right?
Or it'd just be one for one.
Oh right.
Yeah.
Okay.
But it just the powers that it has. I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is really
highly,
early days
for
this kind of stuff coming out. But
they
are thinking about how can they have an economy where we are tightly controlled and they are not.
Mm.
That is the planning is well underway for that.
No, I don't doubt. McLeod asks, is there a possibility of another genius move like the petrodollar appearing but in another form? Say, for example, rare earth metals or lithium, etc. I can't help but think that even though these PhDs are disconnected from the world, they might still come up with something clever to push the system further along.
So potentially that's what Putin's doing at the moment, which is oil for gold.
Right.
So that is him really pushing back against the petrodollar and saying, okay, in the future, I will accept...
isn't this revolutionary? I mean, like, this is a totally radical move against the Americans.
So he would just say an ounce of gold buys you $30 barrels of oil or whatever the exchange rate is, and sort of re-peg it like that. And that's brilliant for the rest of the world, because the rest of the world, I mean, some of them produce gold, but all they can get it. But it's a non-dollar system.
Mm.
And also it works for those countries because it's a store of value that doesn't then depreciate against against oil. So the big problem that countries like, say, Sri Lanka, they've got is they hold on to some dollars to buy some oil in the future, and then when they go to buy that oil, the dollars have been inflated away to the point where they can't buy the bloody oil anymore.
Yeah, and so the issue here is that the dollar is essentially worth American power and Americans' ability to impose the hegemony. If Russia does start up an exchange, which is dollars for oil, surely the
gold for oil.
Gold for oil. Surely it's not going to be the raw gold that is transported every time an exchange is going to be made, like you were saying in your gold video. So it's going to have to be some sort of representative paper currency.
Well,
but then that requires the gold to be stored somewhere safe.
Yeah. So you would need a trusted sort of settlement bank.
Yeah.
Now at the moment it tends to be New York or London.
Right.
And these
But the
banks,
Russians aren't going to be happy with that.
No, but could it be Shanghai or Mumbai?
Would you trust those places?
Well, a lot more than you trust the dollar.
Well,
so I mean it's an upgrade for them. Or maybe they will require delivery. I mean, if it's done at the national level, they can hold some of it in advance.
Yeah, I suppose.
Once it goes down to the individual, I don't think we're gonna go back to a gold standard. We're kind of jumping ahead to the fifth episode, but I don't think we're gonna go back to a gold standard for the people. But if we were, it would be purely gold backed, and you'd still have your notes and your credit card and stuff like that.
But that's a workable system, because a nation state can keep a vault of gold and guarantee the money based on that, right?
But at the top level, I mean, if it's we agree to buy whatever it is, 10 million barrels of oil from you over the next month, they probably would ask for the gold under that system.
So we
could see, well, and actually what the BRICS currency is, the Brazil, Russia, India, China and South Africa, it is going to be, they're saying, a commodity-based thing. They're even talking about letting that include things like agricultural goods. I can see a big problem with using...
Perishable
stuff as something to back your currency. I can't quite see that working.
My pears are only going to last a few days.
So I think it's going to end up basically coming back to gold. But, this is emerging, and it's quite interesting. And it could be, the next few years could be the years that break the dollar, or maybe the US find a way to push back against Russia and China. It's all unfolding.
Any consumable material, though, is a bit of a problem there, isn't it? Because, I mean, one of the things about gold is that you don't really do much with it.
Yeah.
It just sits in a vault.
Whereas everything else, like even those rare earth metals, you need. I mean, even silver is used on industrial scales now.
Gold does have uses, but like...
Yeah, but much, much more limited. And, I mean, you just tend to go to copper instead because it's almost as good as gold. And you then don't have to use your gold. So, possible.
Terry asks, should I learn Mandarin?
No, don't worry, because you'll be replaced by an AI anyway.
Great point.
To watch the full video, please become a premium member at lotuseaters.com.